How are you? I'm John Leonard, also known as the Sober Paddy, and you are listening to the Breffni Early Show.
Breffni, you come all the way from Ireland for this adventure.
Isn't Breffni Early a real tonic, full of positivity?
It's an amazing story, Breffni, with a wonderful, happy ending.
All of those things on your bucket list wouldn't necessarily have led you to do the World Cycle Race.
27 countries, 490 days, 18,000 miles on a bike.
You've decided that's it, you're going to keep giving yourself challenges.
Welcome to the Breffni Early Show, where each week we talk to somebody who's interesting, inspirational and motivational. And once again this week we have someone who very much ticks all of those boxes. There's a lot of similarities between my own story and the story of our guest today, but I'm going to let him tell you about them in his own particular way. John Leonard, welcome to the programme.
Yeah, thanks. It's very good to be here.
John, is it John or is it Sober Paddy?
Yeah, look, I've been called a lot of things in all along the day, so whichever really. John is good, but Sober Paddy is how a lot of people do know me online. That's the sort of moniker I took up 7 years ago when I was getting myself together. So,
well, I'm going to stick to John if that's all right with
that's
you.
That's okay,
yeah. We're going to talk about a lot of things. Obviously, there's a lot of different strings to your bow, both in terms of an elite Gaelic footballer as a member of the Dublin senior panel for a couple of seasons back in the last decade, at the end of, in Pilar Caffrey's time of management, and also as a travel writer, as a film producer and a director, and also as a drug addict.
All of the above, yeah.
That might be, for people who aren't familiar with your story, that might be a bit of a surprise based on the first ones, but we're going to come back to that and talk about all that in a lot of detail over the next hour or so. But I want to talk about you growing up and John Leonard as a teenager in Dublin. What was your life like?
Well, my life was like a kind of a standard version of a good boy who was good at football. I was quite into my sport. I really did love training and I loved playing with different football teams. I was the captain of the school football, GAA teams and soccer teams. And I was did quite well with the local underage soccer teams and GAA teams too. And I loved it. I really enjoyed it. I was quite outgoing and trained hard. And that was me, you know. That was pretty much what I did the whole time. I was a nice young kid, you know. I was into sport. I love going to see Dublin games. I used to love watching Match of the Day and that kind of stuff. And I did dream of being a professional footballer or else to play with the Dubs at Dublin senior level. That's what I wanted as a little boy growing up. That's what I wanted through my teenage years. And that was something that I really aspired to. So that was my upbringing was along those lines. I didn't really deviate too much from that, you know. It was very textbook kind of stuff, really.
And in terms of, let's start with the professional football, where did that go? You played soccer with clubs and schools or?
Yeah, look, I played with Baldoyle United, the local team, but we had a really, really quality team. We used to win all the North Dublin leagues and I played on the representative North Dublin teams and that through the years. And I did quite well and I had scouts watching me at certain stages. And in my last year under 18, we were playing against the game against Home Farm United, one of the best schoolboy teams. And we drew with them a couple of times in a quarterfinal of a cup game and they eventually bet us on penalties. But a scout had been out watching the game and he again came, watched me in a few more games and then came to speak to my family and he was extremely excited about me going over and doing a week trial and signing a deal at the end of it with Oldham at the time, who were a Premier League team. And he was also linked to Everton as well and he was talking about maybe going to that to train with them afterwards. So I was extremely excited, but there was a kind of mess up where we'd been playing against an under 17 Home Farm team in a mixed age group game and he'd got my age wrong and I was 2 months too old for the under 18 team the following year in the UK and it meant that the deal was over. It meant that I couldn't actually, there was no point in me going over because I wouldn't have been able to play with the team he wanted me to play with. So that was really a shattering sort of blow for me as a young boy. But irrespective of that, I was still winning the lower level championships with the school as the captain and that kind of thing. So things were good. I was on the Dublin minor squad as well around this time. And I was unfortunate that I was the third choice goalkeeper. I got cut from the championship squad. So that was another blow for me around that age when I was 17, 18 and trying to really get myself to that next level of football. And unfortunately it didn't work. I I didn't make it either in either of those brackets. And around that time, there was no under 21 National League for soccer players. And when you sort of got cut from the GAA at that level, there was nothing, you know, there was no sort of comeback for a few years. So I really felt after I finished school around that time, my football career was pretty much dead and done and dusted. That's the way I felt about it. It was tough, you know.
So at 18 years of age, what direction did you go with your life at that point?
There was a few different things that happened. I also, I didn't believe in certain. I didn't do very well. I've been playing too much football and that kind of stuff. And I only put down one college course, which was journalism, on my OCS form. There was only just one course. It was ridiculous, really, when I look back and think about it. I was just quite sure that I'd get it, which I didn't get enough points for at all. So I'd no college to go to, and I'd no work experience or anything from work, and I hadn't been working there, so I had nothing. I didn't have a girlfriend as well. I'd been trying hard to get a girlfriend at the time, and I couldn't get one.
That's your main priority when you're 18, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. You want to, you know, I was still a virgin, you know. I wanted to sow my seed, and I hadn't done it yet. So that was a real tough sort of part of my life. There was a lot of things that I was trying to do that were failing, you know. So I started going down a wrong road. I started to drink. Friends of mine who'd been drinking for a few years, I started to join in with their crowd because I thought that sporting life was over. Poor me, I didn't have a girlfriend. And I just thought, look, this is what I'm going to do. So I started drinking cans and flagons, and different lads started smoking hash, and that's all. I started smoking a little bit of hash. And back then in Dublin, there was a lot of pills around. They were after coming in from Amsterdam and London and that kind of thing. And yeah, I started getting into that. But that, I mean, part of the sort of subtext of all this is that there was something sort of bigger that happened and had come out around this time too, which really did impact me on a massive sort of psychological level, which was something that I was kind of running from.
As a schoolboy with Father Ivan Payne.
So it was around this time that I'd been arguing with my dad back and forth about going to Mass for a few years. I didn't want to go anymore. And we used to talk about it and argue about it and talk about church. And I used to argue about the priest and this kind of thing and back and forth with him. And this one day, it was within a few months of all these disappointments with the football and we were arguing up in the porch of the house, and I started laying into this one particular priest, like you say, Ivan Payne. He's like, "Geez, John, what's wrong? What did something ever happen?" And it turned out that I'd been an altar boy up in Sutton Parish in North County Dublin as a little kid when I was sort of from the ages of 8 to 10, I think. And it turned out that Ivan Payne was a paedophile, and he'd been abusing me, and he'd been abusing other boys, and that day in the porch with my dad, we were arguing back and forth, and I was effing and blinding this priest, and like you said, he said, "What, did something ever happen?" I said, "Yeah, you know what, Dad, something did happen," and it all came flooding out, and I'd been carrying this kind of secret, this sort of deep secret around on my shoulder for the guts of 10 years, and I'd never really consciously thought about it, but it was coming out in subconsciously, and it all came apart that day. Our sort of family unit was broken. The religious aspect of our family was part of our culture. It was something that was it's identified us, and it was kind of shattered. And I had to go up to the police station when my mother brought me up and make a statement to the cops about what had happened, and that started this massive investigation, not into only into Ivan Payne, but into all the way he was moved from parish to parish. He'd been moved from the children's hospital to Cabra Parish out to Sutton, where he'd been abusing kids, and people were complaining about it. The level of cover-up and that kind of stuff was it's disgusting. It beggars belief, really. We won't go into that right now, because but all this was happening at the same time. So bring it back to the story, and that's what, not only was I disappointed about the football and disappointed about not being in a further education or have a good job or a girlfriend, but this stuff, this madness of being abused was after surfacing and had come out, and it caused this massive flux in my personality. It caused a massive shift in the way I felt about myself and the way I felt about life. And to deal with all that, instead of actually what responsible people should do, is what I should have done was speak to a Samaritan or speak to a counsellor or get in touch with somebody. I just thought I was going to deal with it myself in classic Irish tradition. And by dealing with myself, of course, I mean drinking and taking drugs. And that's what I did for a long time after that. It started that day, really was a real turning point for me where things went downhill.
But you're still playing sport to a, like, on most people's level, okay? It's not with the Dubs, with the minors, but it's at club level, you're still involved in sport. You're still a functioning student. And while the drugs and alcohol have kind of come into your life in a major way, you're still able to get on with the day-to-day life and probably keep that pretty secret.
Yeah, I was quite good at covering up what I was up to. And I was, for the period of 3 or 4 years, I would have been stoned every day. There was, you know, constant smoking of hash. And every night or two, I'd be drinking cans. That was what I was doing. And at the weekends or other nights, I would be taking pills. And at the same time, like you said, I'd gotten invited out to train with the St. Sylvester senior club team. And I managed to get the number one goalkeeper position. I was only 18 and had a team full of inter-county stars. So that was a really thrilling time for me too. But the whole time I was actually stoned. I was going to training stoned, and I'd turn up even in university. I'd go there, I'd be stoned and drunk. I'd managed to repeat my leave and get enough points to do arts out in UCD. And I'd gone and done that. I'd put two college courses down, this time on the CAO, CAS form. So I did.
Only two this time.
Yeah, well, I thought I'd definitely get enough for arts. I thought, you know.
I'm pretty sure I put down 20, just because. There was 20 spots I filled them with stuff I didn't really want to do, but I was like, just in case.
Yeah, I don't know. There wasn't very much I really wanted to do in further education. I saw myself as a writer. I saw myself doing journalism or doing something to do with English. If I don't get those, well, then I'll figure it out from there. But I was functioning at quite a high level. I was still playing with the Sylvester's Club. We won a Dublin Club Championship. We went to a Leinster Club Final. We had a great team. We got to another Dublin Club Final the following year, and I was playing the whole time. And then I got called up to the Dublin Under-21s, which was massive for me because I'd wanted to do it all my life. It'd been a dream to play Championship football with the Dubs. So I was still having. Good things were still happening to me. Great things were still happening to me. Yet when I think about it, when I look back at the capacity that I was actually operating on, was probably close to 60% in terms of I was physically and mentally, I was never completely there because I wasn't actually sober.
Are you standing on the pitch and during a game thinking about your next hit? Or are you in the moment at the time?
It depends. It depends on what the night would have been before. I mean, it depends on the game. Not normally I can get into a game, but there would have been times where, you know, I'd go to play a game for the club and I would have still been up from the night before. I wouldn't have slept. I'd still be out of my mind, but I'd be able to. I remember a couple of lads getting me in the dressing room before and hitting me a few slaps across the face, going, come on, Lenny, get it together. They used to call me Lenny, you know, because I'd obviously still be a little bit out of my mind.
And would they have known at the time that, or would they have just thought he's zoned out?
They would have just thought that something was up, that I don't know. It's kind of hard when you've only got a 20-minute window in a dressing room before a game to sort of gauge how everybody else is. So if I would have been normally I'd be quite focused and into it. But, I mean, in answer to your question, I probably would have been able to switch into the zone of playing. And I wouldn't really been worried about going out later on that night unless, you know, my attention in the game actually sort of dwindled. If we were winning quite well, then I might drift, you know, which is a trouble for goalkeepers. Concentration and goalkeeping is a massive.
I know that pain myself. My reason for being a goalkeeper was because I didn't like running. So I could
see. There you go. Good reason.
I could stand in goals. I got 30 minutes for the county minor team.
Yeah.
And that was it. That's my inter-county career.
It's not bad. It was better than my minor county career anyway.
You know. Well, you had a much, much more esteemed county career, which we'll get on to. Mm. You, obviously, under 21 and big influences in your life around that time would have been the likes of the late Dave Billings and Brian Talty with the club. Were they helpful to you in any way, or did they have any knowledge of what was going on?
They didn't really know, to be honest, but like they, especially Brian Talty. I mean, Brian Talty was incredible because it was back sort of in the time before mobile phones were in everybody's hand 24/7. And he would actually call into my house. He used to drive past my house on the way out to Malahide. And he'd call in, he'd knock in and pick me up on the way to training 2 or 3 times a week. And, you know,
Was that because he knew you probably might not show up if he
had no, I don't know. He was just giving me a lift. I don't know. He didn't worry about me. I was the thing about my personality is I'm extremely not compulsive, the wrong word. I have an addictive personality, and so something that I like, I want to do more of. And I love playing football, and I wanted to do more, and I love training, and I want to do more of it. And so I don't think there was ever too much danger of me not showing up. And because I was extremely fit, and I did excel when I was a young kid playing football, people probably didn't notice that I was, you know, stoned or drunk or anything. I never went to training drunk too often, but certainly being stoned is something you can hide. You know, you put some eye drops in and, you know, off you go, and that's it. Like, no one really knows that you're that there's something going on
until you try and talk to them.
Yeah. But even that, I mean, after a while you build up your tolerance and you build up your ability to actually just talk while you're in a different kind of zone. So, you know, Brian Talty was amazing because he believed in me, you know, and he gave me an opportunity, and it was fundamental to me excelling at even at the under 21 level. And then Davey Billings as well. Davey was a great man in Dublin GAA, and I remember we played a game, a trial game, and it was in my second year in under 21. There's 3 years in under 21. And he came, we played against the senior team, and I pulled off a couple of saves. And it was about 6 months before, or it was about 3 months, sorry, before the actual championship. And he came over to me, put his arm around his shoulder, and he goes, "John, that was a great display today. You're going to be my number one keeper. There's going to be other lads coming and going and trial and this and that, but I want you to know you're the number one. I want you to have confidence in that and build on that." And that was it. Off he went, and there was other trial games and other keepers, but I knew in my head I was going to be number under 21 goalkeeper, and it gave me massive confidence, and it was a beautiful technique, and true to his word, I was the number one. And it was a great way of instilling, he probably saw in me that I was, you know, you can see things in people, and I'm sure he might have saw, look, this guy could be teetering on the brink of something over here. I dyed blonde hair at the time, and had a bit of an attitude and that kind of stuff at certain respects, and he probably saw something, and he went, okay, I'm going to give this guy something to believe in and to aim for. And that was amazing for Dave, you know. He was a good man for that, and it was something I'm grateful to the two of them, man. They really believed in me, so it was amazing.
Well, you probably would have known Dave from his time in UCD as well. Were you involved with the football team in UCD?
No, I didn't really. He was overseeing it at the time, but I didn't. He was just starting off there, and I didn't really bond with the UCD team, so I went. I was the freshest keeper the first year, and I actually dropped a high ball in a gale conditions in the last few minutes, and I dropped a ball and then took down. He was an Armagh forward at the time. I can't remember his name, and I pulled him down, and he got a penalty. Stood up and took it into the corner, and we lost by a point in the last few minutes. So they didn't really respect. We had a great team. We had lots of, you know, the John Dively, Michael Savage, the Tyrone wing forwards, Brian Dewar as well played in that team. There was real quality throughout it. And then when I went to do a trial game for the Sigerson team, and I just kind of got a bit disillusioned, but it just didn't make sense to me. I was too busy with lots of other stuff anyway. So the UCD didn't. Yeah, I was playing club championships and under 21 Dublin, and trying to get on with being my own man and getting stoned drunk and that. So yeah,
you talk about getting stoned and getting drunk. When did that become your life, essentially? When did that become the main aspect of what you did every day?
It was always there, and I think with the GAA, I always had an out from it. There was always something that was pulling me back in, and so that was great because that did stabilize me. But then once, what happened was, I finished, graduated out of university, and myself and a friend of mine, we went over to Australia. We left Ireland. I kind of had enough here. There was so much stuff going on. The trial with Ivan Payne was going on in the background, and there was all dealings with lawyers and that kind of stuff, and his court case came up just a few weeks before I actually went to go away. But I was kind of disappointed with things. John O'Leary, the old Dublin goalkeeper, he retired, and I never got a call up for a trial for the seniors, and all these things sort of compounded on top of each other, and I just thought I had to get away. And I did. I went to Australia with a friend of mine and didn't come back for nearly 3 years, and I didn't kick a football. I kicked a football in the first couple of weeks, and then I didn't do it anymore. I just gave it up, and that was really when I really went down the dungeon of complete addiction. I got right into just living for the party, living for drinking and drugs and carrying on. You know, I was a bit of a, I turned into be like, you know, the thing was, my relationship with my family wasn't great because I was either coming up or coming down, or I was never really myself. And my friends, I recently found out that my friends actually thought I was a bit of a dick, excuse my language, back then, because I wasn't a very nice person. I was nice when I was a young kid growing up and that, but as I got drunk and stoned, because I wasn't sort of doing it to just be social and that, I was masking something, and I was actually pushing people's buttons through my own insecurities. I was having a go at people all the time, which I thought funny. So my friends didn't really, they tolerated me and weren't too, they just didn't really like me, you know. So it was kind of weird to hear that recently. But look, it was 3 years then in Australia where I got right into the drug scene and that kind of thing. And
yeah. When we talk drugs, what are we talking? What substances?
At this stage, I tried everything. I tried all the hashes and the weed, speed and cocaine. I tried heroin a couple of times. I'd smoked it. I'd done all the pills that were going, whatever, you name it, and I tried it. And it was remarkable for me to see, like, you know, I was smoking heroin when I was 18 to see what it was like, because, again, I didn't really realize, and that's how, it's amazing how quickly you can get into these kind of things if you're not conscious of what's happening. And I was just going with the flow. And I talk a little bit about now, I talk in schools and that, and it's vital that people understand that they're actually responsible for what they're doing, no matter if you think you're not. You're, every day, every decision you make, even whoever's listening to this right now has made a decision to click play on your podcast because they want, they're in charge. They're, you know, whatever's happening, you're doing it and that you're in control. But I didn't really think about it like that. I just thought, I'm sort of going with the flow here. I'm just letting things happen because I'm, you know, poor me and what's ever happened to me. And so I just sort of wandered away with life and I let life take me. And because I was in pain, I was self-medicating, and I was medicating myself heavily. And that, within sort of 6 months of finishing school, I was trying heroin, you know. So, and I, like, my family were good to me. I had always food on my table. They all loved me and that kind of thing. But I wasn't responsible for myself, and I'd never sort of was consciously aware of that fact when I was younger, even though people sort of told me. I didn't really take it in that I could have changed things whenever I wanted.
How did you survive for 3 years in Australia in the drug culture with no family support?
Yeah, by the skin of my teeth, really, because I was working any job. I just worked at whatever I could do. Eventually, I got into working in bars, and I was robbing from them and this kind of stuff. And I had a girlfriend at the time, and I wasn't treating her well. And I was able to survive because other people were doing it too. And you bond with other people who are also on a similar journey, who are also escaping or running for something. You know, everybody's, whoever's, you know, some people take drugs and take alcohol for certain reasons, but a lot of people take it because they're running from something, or they're hurt. And and that was what I was doing. And I was able to meet other people who were doing the same thing. And not that we supported each other, but we pushed each other on to a degree.
What was the low point?
The low point at that period in my life was, it's hard to pin it down. There was times where, you know, I remember one time I went 5 days without sleep from taking speed. And at the end of that, I was a real, real mess. And I remember friends of mine pulled me aside and said, "John, look, you really have to get yourself together. You can't keep doing this." And I just kind of laughed at them and thought, "Well, you don't know what you're talking about, you know." And these were a couple of years older than me, and they really were looking out for me. And I remember in the middle of all that, my granny died back in Ireland, and I wasn't able to. She was my godmother, and I wasn't able to come home for. I didn't have enough money. I'd overstayed my visas at that stage, and I was just in an absolute mess. I'd been coming down off drugs at the time, and I went wandering the streets of Sydney on my own, just really feeling as low as I've ever been, you know. But the thing about that is you just start drinking more and taking more drugs, and you kind of mask that pain as well. So there was a lot of low points, you know. And at the end of it all, in Australia, it was my first stint there. I'd overstayed visas, as I said, and I just had to get out of there. I got back to Dublin. I saved up the last few quid that I had and got back to Dublin in an absolute disheveled kind of state. You know, it was, running away doesn't solve anything. You know, it doesn't. It just makes.
You overstayed your visa in Australia by a period?
2 years, yeah. Two years.
You had a visa for 2 years?
I had a visa for 1 year at the time. They only did 1 year
and
visa.
I stayed
for nearly 2 3/4 years. So.
And you said your first instance, they actually let you back into the country afterwards?
Yeah, luckily enough, it was weird because a week before, the first time round, when I was leaving the country, I met this guy and he said, look, if you need to get out of Australia, what you have to do is go to the immigration a few days. I told him I'd overstayed my visa and I was going to get banned and all that. And he said, look, if you want to get back, go to immigration and tell them your friend has had your passport and has been missing in the outback and he's just come back with it and he's been gone for a year and a half. And I said, that is not going to work. And he said, believe me, somebody else just did it. And I went, okay, well, I'm going to come up with my own idea. So I went into immigration and I'd actually been going out with an Australian girl and we'd all these photographs and we were thinking about going de facto on this kind of stuff. So I went into immigration and I brought these photographs and letters and all this kind of stuff.
De facto, just before...
To explain, is when you get a visa, it's when you're living with somebody for a period of time,
for a year or two,
as a partner. Yeah. So we had been living together. And so I went into immigration and I went into them and I said, look, I've been going out with this girl for the last year and a half. She's after breaking up with me and dumping me. We were going to be going de facto and I know I overstayed my visa, but I know that in the court system there, you actually do get a visa, even if you do overstay, if you can prove it. And he was sort of looking at me and I was looking at him and he said, okay. Right. And I said, what's happening now? And I said, look, my heart is broken. I'm all over the place. And I want to go home. I just want a visa out of the country for the day. I've got my tickets booked. I showed him my tickets and he kind of looked at me and went, hang on a second, mate. And he went off into the office and he came back and he goes, there's your visa, mate. Good on you. And I went to the airport and then the visa guy looked at my visa as I was leaving the country and he brought me into the office and questioned me and then he went, okay, you're good to go. And that was it. Luckily enough, by the grace of somebody, they said, okay, you can go, because...
It's funny. I didn't overstay by 2 years. I overstayed by about a week, yeah. Right? 90-day visa. I overstayed a week and I rocked up at Sydney Airport. No, about a week beforehand, I knew, because I was cycling. Right. I had to get to Sydney to fly out. And I had about maybe 1,500 kilometers to do and only 7 days to do it. And I didn't really feel like doing it at that pace. So I rang the immigration officer and asked, like, what's the situation? How do I extend my visa? And they're like, oh, you got to pay something crazy, like $400 or $500. And then we'll consider it. But if you don't get the visa, you don't get the money back. Right? It's, you pay just to get considered. Wow. And you might not even get the visa at the end of it. And I said, okay, well, what's the nuclear situation? What happens if I rock up at the airport and they don't, and I'm leaving? And they go, well, if it's longer than 28 days after your visa, you will be, if you're not already leaving, you'll be deported and you may get a ban. And I was like, okay, so for 28 days, I may get a ban. I'm like, I'll take my chances. So I rocked up and there was like a 19-year-old girl or 20-year-old girl at immigration and I got sent over to talk to her and I just did the usual, use the Irish accent.
Oh, yeah.
A treat.
The minute
she heard the Irish accent, she goes, where are you from? I said, I'm Irish. And she goes, straight away, it's like, oh, that's not a problem. Just don't do it again. And I was
beautiful.
It was absolutely fantastic. So it worked out perfectly.
Yeah.
There's a story about how you ended up in India, which I find quite interesting. You didn't even make that decision.
Yeah, like, I did. I came back from Ireland and I spent a bit of time. I tried to settle back here after Australia and I couldn't really settle. I eventually was all over the place and I went back to Greece. I got a job in Greece working in a bar there. Had a mad summer there. But by the time I got back from Greece, I was in an absolute mess because I'd become a complete and total alcoholic in Greece. And I'd spent a few weeks back in Dublin really trying to figure out what I was going to do because I just couldn't handle being here. And one day myself and my sister went into Dublin city centre and into an internet cafe there on Talbot Street and sat down and I really honestly didn't know what I was going to do. So I wrote down three places. One was Sweden, one was France and one was India. I asked my sister to pick a number between 1 and 3 and she picked the number 3 and that was India. So I had a little bit of money saved up in my account and I went and I booked tickets there and then to go to India. And 2 weeks later, I left Ireland again and went landed in Delhi, and that started off a mad few months in my life. It was a real.
There's one interesting story. I know I've heard you speak because we spoke at the same event a few weeks ago, and you talked about coming out of a place and a guy offered you drugs and he started listing them all off, and in your own head you're like, no, I've done that, and then the magic word opium was said.
Opium was something I'd kind of romanticized in my head from reading certain authors over the years, and when I heard that this guy had it, you know, I just followed him down to his little hut on the side of this mountain up near the Himalayas, and went in, and he eventually sold me this Kit Kat stick of opium, and I'd no idea how to smoke it. I was too arrogant or obnoxious to actually ask him how I ingested this stuff, and it was before the time of Wi-Fi or anything like that. So I went back to my little hotel room and tried to figure out how to smoke opium, how to take opium. So I put it in tea and smoked it in a bowl and tried to smoke it in other ways, and eventually I figured out how to do it.
Which kind of sounds like a scene from An Idiot Abroad.
Yeah. I haven't seen An Idiot Abroad, but yeah, I was an idiot and I was abroad. So yeah, it probably would fit in quite well. So that's what I eventually got into smoking that. It was a mad drug. It sent me quite into this sort of high reverie of madness, you know. I remember taking it a few days later. I was at a party and I'd smoked a lot of it, but I was at this party and I was dancing around up on the side of this mountain, and there's all these old men with big long sort of white beards and sort of wizard looking caps, and I met a guy from Cork actually who was going to give me some acid, and I dropped it in the mud and I got angry about that, so I stumbled out of the party and I went out to the sort of clearing where I wanted to smoke the rest of my opium on my own. I didn't want to share it with anybody, so I went to sit down. I sort of stumbled and fell into a bush, and I put my hand down and the ground gave way, and I sort of grabbed onto this bush and pulled myself back, and I looked down, and it was this sheer drop of a few thousand meters into this black abyss, and nobody knew who I was at the party. Nobody knew where I was in India. My parents and family just knew I was in India, and India is a pretty big place.
Yeah, it's as big as Europe.
And I was actually on the brink of fall, and I was like, man, you just nearly died because you're stumbling around this party. And it should have been, again, and there's so many moments in my life that should have been wake-up calls to either close to physical death or close to mental turmoil. But I never had the tools. I never gave myself the tools to sort of recognize that or be confident in my own abilities to be myself, you know. So it was, yeah, it should have been a wake-up call, but it wasn't. I carried on in India and carried on into a descent of mayhem.
We've focused on all the negative stuff. Let's start getting into some of the positive side of your story, because your story actually ends extremely positive. Not ends, but it continues in a much more positive light after that. You found yourself on Palawan Beach in Goa, and you made a resolve to try and attempt to achieve three goals. Mm. What were the goals and why did you set them?
I was close to the end of my tether. I'd been smoking a lot of the charis, which is a hash over there, and drinking every day and taking drugs like ketamine every day, which is a hallucinogen, and really losing my mind. And I was close to the edge of insanity and depression and madness, and all these things were really heavily weighing on my head in this beautiful, the most beautiful part of the world. And here I was in close to insanity and in this turmoil in my mind. And I sat down one day in a cafe and I said, you're going to have to write a few things that are going to make you happy, John, and go and do them, because otherwise you're going to physically die or you're going to lose your mind altogether. So I did. I wrote down three things. One was to go back to Ireland and be close to my dad. The second was to write a book. And the third was to play for the Dubs. And they were the things that I thought would make me happy. You know, they were the things, they were goals. I didn't realize it, that I was writing goals. And, you know, if people are listening and they're sort of feeling dissatisfied with the way their life has gone, one good thing, which I found, is to actually write down three of the most outrageous things that will make you happy. And I know that you're a big fan of this. I've seen
I went for 10.
Yeah, I saw your list.
I should have stuck at three.
Yeah, I was doing baby steps for me, but it's an incredible way to motivate the subconscious mind and the imagination, because a lot of these, what may seem like unobtainable goals, when you put them down on paper and you set them into your imagination, things start to tick, things start to work to get yourself closer to making them reality. And I was able to do the first one. The first one was go back to Ireland and be close to my dad. And that was something I could do. And that's what I did after I went and I decided to go back to Ireland.
Physically, that's easy. But mentally, and you've also got your dad's considerations. I don't know what the family dynamic was at the time or the relationship between you, but sometimes you've burned so many bridges that you don't have any say in that anymore.
Yeah, that is definitely a possibility. And physically, like you say, it was possible for me to do, and I did. I came back, I left India, I got back to Dublin, and I used to go to my dad. I'd come down to the house and sit with him for a couple of hours and chat to him. And luckily enough, he wanted to have a relationship with me still. He wanted to know his son better, you know, because I'd been away for years, you know. I'd been an alcoholic and a druggie, and we'd been, our relationship had fractured since my teenage years, you know. It had been going so well as a kid. He used to train me out in our front garden and stuff. We had a great relationship, but it had been fractured for many years. But we managed to pull it back, and we spent hours in the evening chatting about this, that and the other. It was great. We built that relationship back up. And then because I was in that zone of trying to do something that would make me happy, other things started happening. I met a nice girl. I got a better job. We moved in together in the city. And my dad had encouraged me to go back playing football. And I did. I went back with the club. I went back to St. Sylvester's. And I really put as much effort as I could into training and that kind of stuff. And because of all these things, because of the relationship I was having with my dad, was kind of, it's a pure thing. And he was a teetotaler all his life. He never drank or smoked or anything. And because of that, I was cutting back on what I was getting up to. My addictive habits were being curtailed, and I started to get back training and stuff, and that set wheels in motion for me to start performing back at a very high level again. And I got back to the number one club position as the goalkeeper, and luckily enough then for me, the two men you mentioned earlier on, Davy Billings and Brian Talty, they became part of a new Dublin senior team set up when Pillar Caffrey came to power in Dublin.
And for me, the power came to
power. Oh, yeah.
All-seeing, all-doing.
Hallelujah. Yeah. The all-powerful, omnipotent. But he did influence me massively for that, my dad. You know, it was great to get that kind of push from him again, you know, and that kind of encouragement. A lot of time had passed from the hurt that I'd gone through with the abuse and all that kind of stuff. And not that I'd reconciled any of it, but it had faded away to a degree. And even though I hadn't done anything, it was just a good bit away in the background. I wasn't sort of reacting to it as badly anymore. And luckily enough, I did. I managed to, the Dublin thing changed, and I got called up for a trial. And I went out and played this trial game and got invited to go and train with the Dubs. And I did. I went training with the Dubs. It was incredible for me to, 18 months previously, have been in India, out of my mind, losing my mind, nearly falling off cliffs on all kinds of drugs and alcohol and stuff, to be with the Dubs, my childhood team. It was amazing for me. It was an incredible turnaround. And it happened with that decision that day, making a few goals, three outrageous goals. And because I'd put one of them into place, the next one had sort of come from that. And so for me, it was a great feeling, and I knocked a lot of things in the head. Instead of drinking and smoking and doing all the rest of it, I was now training harder and really pushing myself to do everything I could to get the number one spot in the Dublin setup. So, yeah.
Obviously, unfortunately for you, yeah. I've seen you described in certain places as the best goalkeeper you've never heard of, which is a compliment in some respects.
Yes.
But you did have the misfortune of being number two, essentially, in the Dublin setup to probably one of the greatest goalkeepers that's ever played the game, Stephen Cluxton.
Yeah, he's without the best, I'd say. There's really no comparison, I think. There are some comparisons for sure, but in terms of someone who's revolutionised the game and how they perceive goalkeepers, Stephen Cluxton's the best beyond any doubt. He'd make any team of any GAA All-Star selection.
Did it frustrate you? Because I know a lot of people, say for example, another sport that you played as a kid, soccer, if you don't make it at Oldham or Everton or wherever, you can go to another club and it's normal for you to say, okay, I'm going to maybe transfer here or there. If that was an option for you, was it, would that have been acceptable, or was it dubs or bust?
No, it is dubs or bust. I mean, I know I've got strong family connections in Galway and Roscommon, especially in Galway, and I know I laughed and joked about it with my cousins and that who are from that part of the woods, but it's sort of hard with the GAA. It's kind of in your blood, you know. It's kind of in your DNA to want to play for your local county, and I completely understand when people go and move somewhere and live there for years, they feel a connection. And I do still have that connection with Galway. I do feel it's part of me. So, look, if the Galway management had set up and given me a ring and said, listen, we want you to play championship next week or next year, if you come down and train with us, and I wasn't going anywhere at Dublin, potentially it was something I could have considered, but I don't know. It never happened. So it's a hypothetical that really... I probably shouldn't give too much airtime to you, know.
There's an interesting story that I've heard about how in a game you're sitting in the bench in Croke Park and a player comes through and Stephen fouls him and you're willing him to get sent off. How much of a factor in your head is it to support the team and support the guy you're battling for the jersey with, and also kind of wishing him ill in terms of maybe getting injured or getting suspended?
Yeah, I think every footballer is the same, and I'm no different. I probably think about it and talk about it a little bit in my own way, but I would probably prefer to play than, you know, I would love to have played, and I would rather have Stephen got injured or got sent off in order for me to play. You know, there's no doubt about it, and I would. You know, you're thinking, well, why would you do that so the Dubs would lose? And I'm like, well, no, because I'd do a better job than Stephen Cluxton, you know. So I never considered him to be a better goalkeeper than me. I never did. I still don't, even though he's an incredible goalkeeper. And that's the kind of mindset you always think, I want to get out there and prove myself. And so I always thought, excuse me again, if I could get out there, I'll pull off these incredible saves, which I could do. And I'll show that I'm the best goalkeeper in Ireland. And he never did. And I did. I used to sit there and I'd imagine him getting sent off. And that particular game was the Leinster final against Loughley. And I can still see it in my mind. And he pulled a guy down, rugby tackled him. It was a professional foul. It's a black card in the modern game. Unfortunately, they weren't around back in those days. And he just got a yellow card. But I used to do that. And I used to train on my own and imagine and visualise him getting sent off or pulling his groin in the warm-up or something happened to my home, and then hearing in training, because I used to visualize playing, and in order for that to work for me to be authentic, it had to come from an authentic place, and he was never going to get dropped for me. So I had to imagine.
He had to be unavailable.
Yeah. So I should have really got a voodoo doll or something, you know, and sat at home just poking it into his knees or his back.
You're probably the only dove who actually supports Dublin GAA that actually was wishing ill on...
Yeah, yeah.
But I think anyone who's listened to the podcast understands, and I'm sure there's a pretty good professional, at least, relationship between yourself and Stephen over the years.
Yeah, look, he's the most prolific trainer I met in Dublin. In the setup, he was incredibly dedicated. And I was too. I put myself through an immense amount of gym work and mental work and physical work with him and the other goalkeepers. So I think he respects that, and we definitely had that understanding that we were both doing as much as we could, and from that you can build a friendship. When you know you're on the same sort of level in terms of applying yourself, then you can sort of have a relationship from that, and certainly we did have.
Moving forward, I suppose Pilar Caffrey leaves the job and a new man comes in, doesn't quite include you in his plans. And it all goes Pete Tong again.
Yeah, look, the thing about the goals I set in India, they were goals to be happy, and I sort of saw them as being other things that are going to make me happy. Being with my dad, or getting back with the Dubs, or writing a book. These things which existed outside, and eventually my dad passed away at the start of me being with the Dubs. And when Pillar eventually dropped me, or when he left and the next manager dropped me from the squad, the Dubs was now gone, and I was left in this abyss, this massive depression, and really I had no skills or tools to deal with the overwhelming sadness that I was encountering. So I resorted back to the things I knew, which was alcohol and drugs and running away again. And within 3 or 4 months of being dropped by the Dubs, I was back in Australia. I was living on my friend's office floor. I was drinking all day, gambling. I was taking drugs. I was in an absolute mess. I was fighting with people, physically fighting with people. And this is me in my early 30s. And it was a real descent again. And it's something that I like to think of now, is that if you're looking for happiness in other things, when those other things don't work out, or if you do get them and then they disappear, well then what are you left with? And so I like to always try now to find happiness in myself on the path of trying to get and attain other good things. So I like to say to love yourself, to love my own self. And I love myself now, but not in a weird, selfish, narcissistic,
more
arrogant
just
way.
Justin Bieber kind of.
Yeah. I'm just happy with myself. And I'm comfortable with my flaws and with my history. And I've made peace with all that, a lot of that stuff. And so, but back then I didn't. I was in an absolute mad state. And I ended up back in Australia. I woke up one day after it was the anniversary of my dad's death. And I woke up in a laneway, and I was in on top of these black sacks of rubbish, and my t-shirt was up over my head, and I was covered in bites and bruises, and I looked for my phone and my wallet, and they were gone. And I kind of stood up and looked around, and I was, after obviously getting a few digs, my face is a bit sore and that, and I just thought, man, this isn't the way it is, this has to stop, this has to really stop. And so I made a decision that day that I was going to try and turn it around. I went home and told the lads who I knew over there, and I said, look, I'm stopping. I have to get sober. I have to really do it. And they were like, we know you do. Yeah. So they were
more
than
happy.
You were
the last person to realise that.
Yeah. So they were like, okay. So I started going about this process over the course of 6 months to a year of reinventing myself and trying to really stop alcohol and not going to the pub and not going... doing anything mad at the weekends and sort of got into this hibernated state. But I was lucky as well that I met a nice girl at the time, and we went out one night, and the next day we went for a picnic down in Bondi. It was a really nice day. She had a little puppy dog, and we went walking along and laughing and joking and holding hands, and we fell for each other and we fell in love. And it was different for me then, because I was trying to get sober, and I was trying to clear out all my old past. And I met this person who knew me as this new person, and we sort of bonded in an incredible way. And within 4 months, I proposed her, and we got married in Bondi in Sydney, a beautiful place of the world. And it was an amazing sort of turn for me. I'd gone from being this prima donna style alcoholic druggie who was having these meaningless relationships to meeting this amazing woman and being sober and starting to have this new part of life. And so over the course of 6 months to a year with her, I got a visa, I got a job, and we started saving, and I started to train again, and I started to work on my mind. And I was still battling with the trying to be sober, but she's a coach and a life coach, and that, and she was able to help me, give me some techniques for dealing with a lot of the stories I had about the past and stuff about the abuse and all these kind of things that had all been there in the background. But because now I was in a far better headspace and I had her support, I really started to turn things around. And one year she gave me a present. Instead of actually buying presents, we gave each other presents for Christmas. And she gave me a website, and I call it Sober Paddy. And it was there that I started making videos and writing stories about what it was for me as an Irishman to start being sober again. And it was tough, because I was dredging up all the stuff about me when I was a kid and past and alcohol. But over the course of a couple of years, I started to connect with other guys and girls around the world who were going through the same thing. And it started to build and build. And then, up to this date, it's been going for nearly just over 6 years, into its seventh year this year. I've connected with amazing people. And it's been from there, really, that I've discovered how to write properly. And the third thing, which I wrote in India, which was to write a book, or not, it was a novel, but what I've written, I'm taking as that was the book. But it was from there that I learned the techniques and how to write again and
you
how to
still write. Write that other novel.
Oh, it's coming! It's coming! It's gonna be a weird one, but it's coming. So I was able to get into that habit again and start writing and start to learn how to think creatively without needing smoke or drink or something to try and inspire me.
So the book that you mentioned was and is Dub Sub Confidential. It's a fantastic. I haven't, and I apologize profusely, I haven't had the opportunity to read it yet. It's on the bucket list, but then I had hoped to buy it directly from yourself so that you would get a little bit extra of the cut, but unfortunately you're out of books. And I will pick it up on my way home today though. And you'll have to sign it for me at some point in the future.
Sure.
But the it's won awards. It's the sports book of the year. It is been raved about on all media for over the last, I think it came out in September or October. And it's been, it's in the last 4 or 5 months, it's been probably one of the talking points of the country. And everyone knows about it. But it's such a vital story. And what you've just shared with us for the last hour or so, it's such a vital story. How much has that changed your life? Because even the Sober Paddy, it was kind of behind, it was anonymous. This isn't Sober Paddy's name on the book, though. It's John Leonard.
Yeah, it's been massive, you know. And especially winning the Sports Book of the Year award changed the dynamic completely as well and really did raise the profile of it. And since then, you know, for me, I've been going around schools. I've been talking in schools and speaking to students in secondary schools all over Ireland. And that, for me, again, like part of Sober Paddy was that I wanted to help one person. When I was struggling, I always just wanted to help one person, and I did. I've connected with thousands of people at this stage, and for me that was incredibly rewarding. But now over the last month or two, I've been able to go to schools all over Ireland and tell them my story, and that for me is massive, because I'm getting to influence teenagers who are, I know, going through the same stuff I went through and having similar doubts, but I'm able to tell them what I did wrong and what they can possibly do right. And for me, that only came because of the book. That's been fundamental in me being able to influence so many kids in schools around Ireland. So that has been extremely rewarding. And, you know, it's something that as I move on in life, I really want to take that on. You know, that kind of the ability to influence people in a positive way is a gift that, you know, when you go through dark times, I've been down at the bottom of mentality and I've been at the lowest points of the low, and to come out of it and to be able to give something back and to share that kind of stuff is amazing. And the book has been fundamental to that, you know. So for me, that award was great. And I think over the next few years, I will obviously write other things, but it's been great to win as well, you know. To succeed in anything does give you confidence, and it's certainly given me confidence to keep building what I'm doing.
In terms of what the listeners can learn from your story, and what would be the three things that you would think, or the three tips or piece of advice that you would give to people who are in maybe not necessarily the same situation as you with drinking alcohol, but stuck in a rut or stuck in with an obstacle in front of them or needing to make a change in their life?
The first thing I would definitely say, and probably the most important thing, is to know that you can always turn things around no matter what stage you're at. All anybody who's listening to this needs to do is to decide that they're going to change. And I've done that a couple of times in my life, and I've made a decision and I've written it down and I've decided that I'm going to change. And I make that conscious, clear declaration, either physically on paper or to somebody else, and I write it down. And from that decision, you take responsibility for what you're going to do. And then if you put things into place, then you can change your life, and you can change it in an instant. You don't need to, you can change it once you change your mentality, and you can do it right now. Somebody listening can turn this off, sit down and go, right, I'm going to change my life right now. This is what I'm going to do. And from that decision, great things can happen. So that is one thing I would say is fundamental to any kind of getting out of any kind of funk. The next thing I would also say is that happiness is something that is inside you. It's not to be found in cars and women or men or status and wealth. They will not make you happy. It lives in your head. That's what I like to say. Happiness lives in your head. And if you can love yourself today, tell yourself, I love myself, I'm a good person. And when you make that decision to allow happiness just to be in your head, all those external variables, the ups and the downs, will not affect you as much as they can. So that is something else, yeah, I'd definitely like to make sure that people know. The third thing is you're responsible for yourself. That's it. You know, nobody else, your parents, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your teachers, your boss, no one else can tell you what to do. Nobody. You can agree with what they ask you to do or tell you to do in certain circumstances, but you are the boss of yourself and you're responsible for yourself. And so I think if people can take on that personal responsibility, you find that so empowering. When you understand that you're actually in charge of whatever you do, that's a fundamental thing. So I'd say, yeah, say to yourself, I'm the boss of me, and move from there.
What does the future hold for John Leonard?
The future is exciting. I hope to stay in Ireland for another few months and do some more talks in different schools. And there's a few other speaking engagements that I'm doing. But at the end of the year, myself and my wife plan to go to Africa for a period of time. We've been making documentaries. We didn't quite talk about it today, but making documentaries about charity projects. And we've been collating stories all around the world. We've been traveling for 4 years now around the world. In Latin America, Asia, Australasia here. And so we want to plan that. We plan to go and keep doing that. We're going to Africa. We've got a website called 5.5.org where we have all these great articles about different people and different projects and what these people are doing around the world. So yeah, we want to build on that and keep helping people. That's it.
What's the 5.5? What's the relevance of the title?
5.5, it's all words. We were looking for this idea before we went travelling a few years ago, and we watched a video about an Indian guy called Narayan Krishnans, and I don't know if I got the pronunciation.
I'm quite impressed you even attempted that one.
So he did this beautiful video. It was made by CNN and we watched it. It was only a couple of minutes long, but he was a former chef and he gave up his job because he was walking past destitute and poor people every day. And he couldn't handle it anymore. So he started a soup kitchen. And then he started to help do different things to actually, he used to cut their hair and love them, give them hugs and all this kind of stuff. And we were watching it and he turned around and he said, we're all human. We've all got 5.5 litres of blood and we're all here. We should use it to make a difference. And we just thought, well,
I didn't think it.
My wife thought it. She went,
I absolutely love that.
5.5. And we all have, that's what we got around 5.5 litres of blood. And we just thought, right, we've got 5.5 litres of blood. Let's use ours to make a difference. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make a difference. We're trying to help charities. We give them videos in order to help them get more money and all the rest of it. So, yeah, everyone's got 5.5 litres of blood. So, yeah, use it.
Absolutely love that. The final question on the show every week is, what can someone listening to this show do for you? If you had one ask.
If I had one ask. I would say connect with me. Yeah, just connect. And if it's on Facebook or on Twitter, at Sober Paddy, just connect with me and say hello. I love to connect with people these days. It's great that, you know, with modern social media, it's a fantastic way of actually just being in touch. So if there's anyone listening who does want to do something for me, just contact me on Sober Paddy, just say hello. Just say hello. Just say, how are you?
John Leonard, Leinster GA champion, award-winning author, best-selling author. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. I think the titles I didn't mention there are the three that I started the show with: interesting, inspirational, and motivational. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and the best of luck with everything that happens in the future.
Thanks very much.